the state Senate passes a bias crimes bill as its co-author votes against it. House Republicans unveil their budget proposal. That plus Dan Coats could be on the chopping block and more on Indiana Week in Review, the week ending February 22nd, 2019.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Built on a 100-plus year foundation of legal service, Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, the Indiana Senate passed legislation labeled a bias crimes law, even as many supporters and one of its co-authors refused to support it.
The hate crimes bill originally included a list of victim characteristics, including race, religion, and gender identity, but Senate Republicans stripped out that list. They claim it wasn't inclusive enough, though they haven't specified who was left out. That change has longtime supporters of the bill, like Democratic Senator Jean Breaux, now speaking against it.
You chose not to move yourselves or to move Indiana forward. You chose not enlightenment, but darkness.
Republican Senator Aaron Freeman authored the amendment. He doesn't like the criticism he's received for it.
And I would suggest to you that a handshake would be great and say, Senator Freeman, thanks for keeping the issue alive.
The bill now moves to the House. Speaker Brian Bosma says his caucus does not support the list of victim characteristics.
What message does the change to the hate crimes bill send? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, State House reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, Republicans say they are trying to be more inclusive. Is that what's happening? I'm guessing
that's
no.
Seriously a question?
Their argument is it's nonsense.
It's a joke. It's a joke what he passed, okay? What Senator Freeman is saying is that if you're gay or you're transgender or Jewish or female or any other of the suspect categories that were removed, that he doesn't particularly care whether you're the victim of violence or not. That's what he's saying. And that message coming from Indiana on the heels of the RFRA legislation, which embarrassed the state, thanks to Mike Pence, embarrassed the entire state. Now we're doing it again. We're saying that, you know, the facts notwithstanding, and the FBI is clear that these groups are targeted for hate crimes. And all the groups that monitor hate crime groups say we're at the highest total, 1,000 in 20 years, the highest total of hate crimes. And here in Indiana, we had a chance to address that question and tell the entire country that no matter what we feel about people who are gay or transgender, we are going to protect them. And instead, we rejected that idea. And when you had a governor who was supposed to be behind this 100% and could only produce 7 votes from his own caucus, including losing his own leader in the Senate, it's an embarrassment.
I want to ask about Governor Holcomb. He sent out a very strong statement on Tuesday saying that this is not the bill that he wants to see. But as we heard in my story news, we heard from Speaker Bosma, there's no appetite to put the list back in the House side. So if this is the bill as it currently sits now or something like it, without that list, if that's what goes to Governor Holcomb, does he sign it?
I'm not going to make a prediction on what he'd do in that scenario because we still have a lot of process ahead of us. We do have a vehicle for hate crimes going forward. But it's going to require what happened the day after RFRA and the photo. The building blew apart, right? And there was incredible political pressure on that General Assembly to go in and fix that problem that they had caused. We all woke up the day after this amendment went in or pulled the list out. And nothing happened. Like there wasn't a whole lot of political pressure in that building the next day. There wasn't a lot of negative downward pressure where they went, man, I regret that decision. I wish we had that one to do over again because the politics kind of moved front and center. So we've got a long process ahead of us. Hate crimes has become, it's going to have to be something outside of that building that forces this list back in somewhere in the House. I don't know what that is. We just had a hate crime committed in Indianapolis. This Muslim man who was killed as a during this road rage incident. We have this incident in Chicago with this fake hate crime thing, or this allegedly concocted hate crime. But there's the people that... So there are external things that might happen. The primary thing, I think, is that the coalition is great of these companies and all these people that have signed on to support this legislation. But I think they believe it should, it makes, as I believe, it makes so much sense to just do it and do it in a comprehensive way that it's probably just going to happen. And that is not true. I mean, these guys, these CEOs have to pick up the phone and call these members who they know and these Republican leaders who they know and say, look, you spend a lot of time bragging about how great business is in Indiana. I'm telling you I want this as a leader of the business community in Indianapolis. And if you don't do it, there's a consequence for that. There's just no part of that fight right now.
Both of these folks have mentioned RFRA. Lawmakers mentioned RFRA. And it was the external pressure that led to that fix just 1 week after the bill was signed. Are we going to see anything like that this time?
Well, given the size of the coalition, Indiana Forward, that Mike alluded to, you would think that we would see something of that nature. It's a huge coalition with a lot of high-profile and very powerful, well-connected organizations. And we've seen statements that the organizations have issued, but really not much more than that. What happened with RFRA, you'll recall, was that other states said we're no longer going to send state employees or municipal employees to your state on business or to conferences. We had professional sports leagues saying we're not going to condone this or events. The NCAA, other sorts. That will get certainly the state's attention because it hits them in the pocketbook. As to your question about will the governor sign it, you're right, predictions are tough, but I think we do have some indication by looking at history. Last year, this same bill probably in this form with the generic, so-called generic language, probably could have passed, emerged and passed. It was the governor who was sensitive to the black eye that Indiana had received in RFRA and the bad press nationally that said, I'd rather, behind closed doors, I think, in caucus, I'd rather not have any bill than that bill, which will make us look bad. So I think the indication, if I had to guess now, is he'd lean toward vetoing it and taking a stand. Because he's been so forward on this, I think signing it basically shows acquiescence.
So this session, and the starting in the summer when we had the incident at the Carmel Synagogue, the governor was more out front on this issue, has been out front on this issue. What has to happen now from Eric Holcomb? Because there are every indication that he is having conversations regularly behind closed doors.
I think he's got to take those conversations public. I mean, mm-hmm. he can testify before the House hearing, which governors have done on occasion for key issues that they support. He can visit them in their caucus room. He can hold a press conference with victims of hate crimes and say why that's important for them to be recognized as not just a target, as regular targets. I mean, I definitely think if it's going to happen at all, you know, I think he definitely has to kick it into gear a little.
All right, well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, and we've asked it before, will the General Assembly pass a meaningful hate crimes law in 2019? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, should school safety dollars be used for firearms training for teachers? 26% say yes, but 74% say no, they shouldn't. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, the Indiana House Republican Caucus unveiled its budget this week that increases education funding by about 2% each year, which basically keeps pace with inflation. State House leaders of both parties say increasing teacher pay is a top priority. The House Republican budget gives schools $461 million new dollars over the next 2 years, a little more than the current inflation rate in increases per year. The caucus budget also includes Governor Eric Holcomb's proposal to spend state reserve dollars to fully fund a teacher pension fund, which will free up some money for schools to spend, potentially on teachers. The House GOP broke with Holcomb over existing teacher appreciation grants, money that goes to high-performing educators. The governor proposed eliminating that program. House Republicans' draft keeps it in place. The budget proposal also gives the Department of Child Services all the money it's asked for, $286 million more dollars per year than the agency got in the last budget. Mike O'Brien, are these education funding increases that we've seen from the House Republican budget enough to move the needle?
It depends on your perspective. I mean, certainly educators are going to think it's not enough. Superintendents are going to believe it's not enough or it's not spread equitably. Those are normally the dynamics of that issue. I mean, the reality is you've got to work within the dollars that are available. Spending in education has gone up 18% in the last 6 years, and this is the most we've ever spent on K-12 education. And so, I mean, it is a staggering amount of money that we put through the system. you know, the companion debate is how are those dollars spent, and that's an issue we took up earlier in the session that House Republicans prioritized earlier in the session on trying to make sure, okay, we're sending this record number of dollars to K-12 education. What are they doing when it gets there, and how can we wrap our arms around that?
And is that really where Mike's right. The reactions are roughly the same as they always are, which is there are folks in the education community, most of them, who always want more. But is this year the debate really more about how are we using the dollars as opposed to the number of dollars?
Superintendents and school boards aren't shredding the money they're getting, okay? They would like to raise salaries, too. They don't have the means to raise salaries. When you talk about a choice between providing health care, heating the building, driving the buses, all the things that those dollars go for, we are effectively paying teachers, adjusted for inflation, what they were making 10 years ago when the state froze property taxes and said, we're going to take over funding, and we know how to do it. Well, they don't know how to do it. They are not putting enough revenue in there to have meaningful raises for teachers and to get that starting salary in so many of those counties above $30,000 a year, which is a disgrace.
In this discussion, there's the one-time money out of the state surplus that House Republicans are going along, and I think everybody supports. But something we haven't talked about a lot is that that doesn't actually mean every school is going to see a bunch of savings from that, right?
No, it obviously there are two different teacher pension funds, so it kind of depends if a school district has teachers that are in the pre-96 fund. And so if you have a district with a lot of younger teachers, they're probably not going to see much from it, you know, because they're in the post-96 fund and are already pretty much funded as they go along. So it is a bit of a difference. I will point out, just for clarity's sake, that I looked back 2 years ago when we were doing the budget. The House Republican budget then gave $271 million in new K-12 money. This budget, $461 million, and that's before the pensions. So they are putting money in there, but you know, obviously, whether that's enough to have a competitive wage is still a question.
And how much of that goes to charters and virtual schools and vouchers? That's the other question.
Well, some Democrats want to raise the corporate income tax.
We want to stop the phase-out of the corporate income tax cuts, not the same thing.
I didn't just complete Indiana Week and Review the bingo card, so we finished it record time.
If we're using Mike's barometer here, which is are people lined up at the doors of the State House ready with torches and pitchforks, ready to react to something that the General Assembly has done, they didn't on the prior issue, and they certainly didn't on this. So I think there is a recognition that the dollars are limited, the budget is tight, and that when you do, Nikki, you put it in real dollars and cents terms there. When you look at that 200 and something million up to 400 and something million, not even counting the pension liability question, I think people will give them credit. And Ann touched on this. The much bigger and more contentious and emotional issue isn't the percentage increase or the dollars, but in fact the tension about funding of private schools, particularly, let's take charter even off the table.
And it's not that it's terribly partisan. I mean, the fundamental issue is very partisan. But the people it's impacting in terms, I mean, you look at who it's impacted a lot are like some of these giant suburban school districts where it's real money
but
now.
Even in some of the smaller
those
ones,
aren't Democrat areas. These are Republicans.
There's no way you can offset the loss with, say, the tension liability.
But there is that element has started.
And the percentage increase.
There's more tension on it, I think, right now. Because we're talking about how are you spending your money?
Percentage-wise, more money is going into that 6% that are in that pool than the 93 to 94%
that are in traditional
schools.
A Washington Post report this week indicates President Trump might fire Director of National Intelligence and former Indiana Senator Dan Coats.
Splits between Coats and Trump are not new. The president and the Hoosier Republican have at times been at odds about the nation's intelligence assessments. The Post report says administration officials worry Coats could be on his way out after Trump has grown, quote, increasingly disenchanted with him. Anonymous sources claim the president thinks Coats isn't loyal and not on the team. The report suggests Coats' firing is not imminent, though perhaps only a matter of time.
John Shaughness, I went back and looked and talked before about Coats' role in the administration a few times now. And at this point, when we're getting the report that Trump is increasingly dissatisfied, if you're Dan Coats, is it better to stay or go?
If it's about his blood pressure and about his quality of life, I'd head to the beach myself. But it's not about all about. He's a public servant. He has spent his entire life serving the country and trying to do it, I think, most people would say, in a fairly, except Ann, who's smirking next to me. But many would say he is one of the few adults left in the room. And so what may be good for Dan Coats' blood pressure may not be good for the American public in terms of having somebody with the seasoning and the understanding, rather nuanced understanding, of our bilateral relationships with any number of our allies, not to mention our enemies.
This is, obviously there's a tension on this because it's Indiana, so for us here it matters because we know Dan Coats here. But because of all of the things that have gone on with people in his administration, are these sorts of stories just rolling off people's backs at this point?
I would think so. And I'm frankly surprised it didn't come beforehand because from what I can tell, I mean, unless you literally worship, you know, President Trump, that you are not showing the proper loyalty that he wants, at least. I mean, the number of people that they've gone through in key positions has been pretty amazing.
If you're Dan Coats, would you stay or go?
I'd go because it's clear that Trump is not going to listen. I mean, it was a unanimous recommendation unanimous consensus of all the intelligence agencies that North Korea is a threat. And he doesn't want to hear it because his buddy, his pal up there, they've connected, you see. And the fact that apparently North Korea is going ahead with the nuclear testing has gone right over Donald Trump's head. And you can't do anything with that. I mean, you can go forward and you can tell the truth, okay, and it's disregarded. So what's his function there?
And that's exactly the conversation we've had, which is John alluded to. There's a sense that Dan Coats believes in public service, believes he can do good where he is. But when we see President Trump undercut what we hear from the intelligence leadership, including Dan Coats, does that give you more of a reason to go, oh, fine, I'm just out of here?
Well, I mean, not if you're Dan Coats, because you do have he's a patriot first, right? So he has had this commitment through his whole career to kind of be the senior grown-up, you know, kind of the grown-up, the steady hand in the room. That's the role he plays here, and it's a necessary one if you look at just the turbulence of, like, the recent changes in senior people, especially in the intelligence community, cycling through here. So unless he's forced to go, he's not the kind of guy who just would throw up his hands and walk out because he was just frustrated or for any other reason, because he believes it's important that someone be there to deliver that message. And he's not the guy who's going to go in front of Congress and throw red meat and not give what he believes and is an honest assessment of the national security.
But if the president completely disregards that and says it's, quote, fake news, which is what he says,
what's the point? If you're Dan Coats, maybe it's, well, I'm still going to tell you what I believe to be
until
the truth.
Until I get fired.
Well, I think it's also the Atlantic Monthly had a great piece this week, which looked at what they say is perhaps his most important contribution, or what he sees as a great passion of his right now, which is protecting the reputation and integrity of career public servants in the intelligence community.
Well, it would be nice to have somebody in that administration that still has integrity and a reputation. This is the most corrupt administration
we've ever had. You already
had
a chance to speak, Ann. We have to move on.
Pharmacists could deny women access to abortion-inducing drugs if they have a moral or ethical objection under a bill approved this week by the Indiana Senate. Current law says a physician or hospital employee doesn't have to perform or assist in abortions if they have an ethical or moral objection. This year's bill would expand that to nurses, physician assistants, and pharmacists. Supporters of the measure say it keeps state statute up to date with the changing face of medicine. But Democrats argue the law should also require healthcare workers to let patients know they object to abortion services. The bill's author, Republican Senator Liz Brown, says it's the patient's responsibility to ask.
Nikki Kelly, as abortion bills go at the State House, is this one getting the kind of attention and fervor that we're used to seeing?
No, I've seen very few stories on it. And I think it's probably because, I don't know, I mean, we already had part of a conscious statute for doctors and their employees. The big part of this one is the pharmacist section. And there are, you know, drugs that can, I guess, that they could refuse to fill that actually complete a miscarriage, and I've heard some concern about that. Overall, though, most of the medication-induced abortions in the state, they get the medication at the clinic, so those don't look like they'd be affected.
And this bill isn't about protecting the unborn as much as it is assuaging the conscience of these providers. And if that's the case, it seems to me that the litigation we would see is from other medical practitioners who perhaps are members of faith organizations or denominations that don't believe in psychotropic drugs, who don't believe in the transfer of blood products, any number of things. So they would, it seems to me, be able to stand on the same ground and say, I'm, by giving you this
blood transfusion,
this transfusion or this antipsychotic or this antidepressant, I am violating my own religious beliefs. And what, then do we get basically, you have to have signage outside of every drugstore that says, okay, we do this, but we, and only between this hour, because then second shift is a different person who comes on with a different set of beliefs.
That last point is something that's been discussed in this debate, which is fine. If we're gonna say, yes, if a doctor has an objection, if a pharmacist has an objection, fine. But tell us beforehand.
Yeah, you got to know that when you're going to hire a pharmacist, right? Or an ER doc, or someone who might have a moral or religious objection
that
sets
a
some act.
Is that a role for the law to play, or is that something that should only be the purview of the employer?
Well, I think they'd have to have the right to do that, and I'm not sure they do. I'm not sure you do have the right when you're interviewing a prospective employee
to ask their religious
affiliations and what parts of their religion they actually like practically, you know, adhere to. The reality is they take an oath here. I mean, they are taking an oath
in this. Is that the fight to have then on this?
This is a solution in search of a problem, okay? This is to kowtow to the right wing of the Republican caucus and their supporters. That's what it is. Because when was the last pharmacist fired because he refused to provide, or he or she refused to provide such a drug?
Well, in many ways, this is not a problem. This is not so much an abortion bill as a RFRA redo, it seems to me, because that was all about giving certain people in certain career or lines of work, the ability to say...
Well, then it also becomes, do you have to prove that you believe strongly about this particular issue, which becomes...
Do we have lie detectors on that? Or how many times do they go to church a month? I mean, it's ridiculous. And it's another example of how the legislature wastes its time and our resources.
It seems like you could figure this out. I mean, through the course of just like employment, where you're... If you're a pharmacist, you're like,
might happen.
And you don't get the job because you don't believe in abortion, and then you have an EEOC complaint filed because you've been discriminated on the basis of your religion.
Right. Well, the House passed legislation this week that once again overhauls the state's school accountability system.
The Indiana State Board of Education approved new graduation pathways in 2017, which stressed the importance of schools preparing students for life after high school, whether they go to college or jump straight into the workforce. House-approved legislation seeks to align the state's school accountability system with those new pathways. It doesn't specify exactly which metrics the state should use to evaluate schools based on that new model, but it does limit high school accountability to include measures that highlight how schools keep students on track to graduate on time, how prepared students are for life after high school, and post-secondary outcomes, or what they end up doing after graduation.
And Delaney, a lot of accountability changes. Are we finally driving towards the right model with this one?
Nobody even knows. I mean, how many times have we changed this model? I mean, since George W. Bush and No Child Left Behind, we've done that, I think, every year. And they don't stand up and say, well, you know, A, B, C, D, and E didn't work, and you know, or F didn't work, and so now we're going to try this, and that didn't work, so now we're going to do this with ISIS. Just leave it alone and put enough money in there to pay teachers good salaries and let the process work.
Is that the problem here?
Did you say ISIS?
He did. But
did
it's okay.
You know what I meant.
I don't know what you were making.
Is this the problem, though, that it's not so much that this is the wrong model, but that it's another change to accountability?
There is some frustration among Republican lawmakers who aren't in this kind of core group of, like,
who are tackling this,
who are educators, who are tackling on a regular basis.
Because
it is hard to understand, and it is complicated to measure the progress you're making. But there is, if you just kind of zoom out politically, when you talk to lawmakers, even Republican lawmakers, they have one of these put in front of them on like a regular basis, and it's like,
and they acknowledge they're just sort of trusting.
And that's not unique to
the
this issue.
No,
but
they all do that on a lot of different issues.
But I think there's general agreement that we should be measuring, and we should, and there should be accountability. We just
don't know how to do it.
We just don't know if it's working.
They still have to take the federal test too to qualify for federal money. So it's not as if you're getting away from it.
All right. Well, finally, the House this week approved a bill to regulate electric scooters. And Republican Representative Sean Eberhard rode one of the vehicles down the House chamber aisle to present his measure. So, Mike O'Brien, what mode of transportation would you ride down the House floor aisle if you could?
Some days a tank. It just depends on the day and what's going on that day. Sometimes a bicycle, sometimes a tank.
Yeah, is tank the best answer?
I prefer to stay away myself.
You know they should just flood the chamber because they all
I'm doing roller skates.
Roller skates. Roller skates.
They don't walk on water, so flood the chamber and they'll just walk on water on the way in there. That's
well, that's just a few lawmakers. That's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the new WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, built on a 100-plus-year foundation of legal service. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients stay ahead of a changing world, working to develop an understanding of each client's needs to help build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.